get more to the story. Now, our next presenter is going to be Dennis Venema. He got his PhD in biology at the University of British Columbia and is now a professor at Trinity Western University, a Christian university that is in the Vancouver area. And I've asked him this afternoon, actually Lauren was the one that helped to invite him to come, to explore what is becoming an increasingly, I think, interesting and very important question about this whole issue of what do we learn from the Human Genome Project? What does it imply about human evolution and or historical Adam and Eve? And I think he's going to be sharing things that are somewhat in the same area as what Francis Collins did in his book, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Thank you for coming. We're glad you're here.
It's a privilege to be here, and I'd like to thank Lauren and Walter for the invitation. My purpose here today is fairly narrowly defined. I will speak, as Walter has mentioned, on genomics evidence for two issues, for common descent with humans between humans and chimpanzees, that these organisms share a common ancestor. And the second line of evidence that we will explore is to look at what genomics evidence can tell us about ancestral population sizes at various times of human evolution. And then I'll make some very brief comments on the theological implications, but we have three theologians speaking afterwards, so I feel somewhat free from that constraint. This opening slide is just here to remind me that evolutionists are not as scary as they might appear to be to some, and also that there are many lines of evidence that support evolutionary biology. You can see our evolutionist. I would have preferred if the cartoon had said Darwinist, but such as it is, it says evolutionist. We have the skull being held out. We have the DNA strand being held out. And you'll notice throughout the talk, I will be focusing only on the genomics evidence. However, there are other lines of evidence, but I am narrowing my focus to one. Okay, so here's just a brief sketch of an outline of what I'm going to talk about. Start off with evidence for human-chimpanzee common ancestry. Then we'll move on to evidence for ancestral hominid population sizes using different methods, and then some very brief thoughts on biblical scientific concordism. Okay, so in terms of evidence for human-chimpanzee common ancestry, I'm going to look at four lines of evidence and then discuss what I believe is the most parsimonious explanation of these lines of evidence. The lines of evidence are homology, redundancy, syntony, pseudogeny, and then the most parsimonious explanation, in my opinion. So, beginning with homology, which is probably the most familiar topic to everyone at a lay level. This is an argument that's proffered very often from a theistic evolutionist side in terms of similarities between living organisms. This is an alignment of one protein that I work on. This is something that you're probably familiar with at some level. This is the amino acid sequence of insulin from various species. And at the very top, we have human, chimp just below, and then a number of other species. This is just the sort of thing you can pull up using BLAST at a very quick and easy way to do. And what we notice between humans and chimpanzees specifically, you won't be able to see it because you're too far away, and even though we have the biggest room, we have the smallest screen, is that of the 110 amino acids that are present in human insulin and the 110 in chimpanzee insulin, there are only two differences at the amino acid level. And they're right there. You won't be able to see them. Now, I won't spend too much time on this argument because it's the one that's the most well-known to you. A very common response from an anti-evolutionary or an anti-common descent position is to say, well, function obviously constrains amino acid sequence. So what we're seeing here is an instance of common design, not necessarily indicative of common descent. I'll move quickly on to the next line of evidence, which I think quite thoroughly refutes that idea that we're looking at common design as opposed to common descent. Now, I'm fully aware that various forms of intelligent design do not deny common ancestry, but I've been asked to speak about the evidence of common descent, so that's where I'm focusing my talk. So what do we mean by redundancy? Well, if you remember from your high school biology or first year level biology for those that have taken such, the amino acid code, the codon code, There are, because it's a triplet code, there are 64 different possibilities. However, proteins in living systems are comprised of 20 amino acids, so there are different available codons available to code for various different amino acids. So while we see constraints, say perhaps to follow that argument for a while, we see amino acid constraint in terms of function perhaps, we can ask the question, what's the underlying genetic code that's producing this sequence of amino acids? Does it match up with what we would predict from common ancestry as opposed to common design? Or to put it another way, are there various design options for this specific amino acid code? Could it be coded in different ways? And the answer is yes, very much so. So we're going to have a quick look at this little tiny bit at the very beginning, highlighted by the box, and have a look at the underlying genetic sequence that encodes for those amino acids. So here's what we see in humans on the top line and chimpanzees on the next line. You'll notice I've included one of the amino acids that's different. What we see here in this small snippet, we see of the 42 nucleotides present, that 41 of them are identical. And the one change in the one codon that's different, it's a single nucleotide change between the codons. Now, a little thought experiment that occurred to me was, if I was going to try to design this sequence in a way that would be the most different in terms of sequence, how far could I drive it in terms of identity? And the answer is, by using the various different codons that are available for these different amino acids, one can actually drive the identity in terms of sequence homology between these two snippets down into the lower 50s range. So from a purely design-oriented perspective, it would be possible to code this sequence using this exact amino acid sequence using a nucleotide code that is almost 50% different. Yet what we see, of course, when we look at the sequence, and here's just highlighting the yellow highlighting the nucleotides that are constrained. You cannot change those ones and have those amino acids in that sequence, but all the other ones are up for grabs, and there are numerous different options for many of these different codons. So if you do a little back-of-the-envelope kind of math, and part of the fun here is that small probabilities, I mean, you can't really do a talk of this nature without, you know, talking about small probabilities, right? It's just a natural part of these types of events. There are a little over 26 million different ways to code this sequence with different codons to achieve the same amino acid sequence. Yet what we see is the one that is the most consistent with the hypothesis of common descent between those 26 million different options. If one takes that logic and extends it a little further, remember there are 110 amino acids in insulin. If you take that logic a little further, here's just a little bit more of the protein, just continuing that logic. The numbers underneath each codon simply indicate the number of possible codons that are available for that particular amino acid. And very soon you can understand in terms of combinatorial statistics that the number of possible options becomes absolutely huge. So just for this sequence of 40 amino acids, we now see that we're up to approximately somewhere in the order of 18 times 10 to the 18 different options for this sequence. Yet what we see again is something that is extremely close, and we see something that is very consistent with only single nucleotide changes inherited and divergence from a common ancestor. Again, doesn't prove anything, but it's suggestive, I think. Now, this is just to make the point that we're looking at just one tiny, tiny little bit of sequence here. And the comparison between the human genome and the chimpanzee genome, now that we have reasonably complete sequences for both of those organisms, the point to make here is that we have a sample size of 2,700 megabases, or 2.7 billion nucleotides. And what we see when we align those sequences one to another is we see a 1.23% difference between those sequences. So we're not talking about just a small region of the genome that seems constrained in this manner. We're talking about vast, vast stretches of the genome. Okay? And another point to make is that if we look specifically at samples from gene exons, which comprise quite a small proportion of the genome, you can see that the numbers are even stronger. We see an even lower difference. We see only approximately 0.6, 0.9% difference. Okay. So that's an argument from homology coupled with an underlying argument of redundancy in the code. But I personally don't feel those to be the most compelling arguments for human-chimpanzee common ancestry, compelling as they are. One thing that is, in my view, and again, these are not separate lines of evidence. They all converge and support one another. What I find quite interesting and convincing is this issue of syntony. And this is something that's not as well known in this origins discussion among Christians, primarily because it hasn't been picked up as a rhetorical tool either for or against by either side. But I think there's something here that we could look at and learn from. Okay, so what do we mean by syntony? I'm a Drosophila geneticist and cell biologist, and part of what we do in our work looking at the chromosomes of flies is that you can tell in different isolates from different populations, perhaps, that chromosomal information, genes in an order, have been rearranged in some way. There's evidence that events such as translocations of information from one site to another, inversions of a section of a chromosome, perhaps, have occurred. And the evidence for that type of event is conservation of spatial information. Basically, we have the same genes in the same order, but it's been rearranged in some way. The evidence is, well, we see the same genes, they're backwards in this section. We can explain this by a breakage and an inversion event, for example. Now, you can apply this same logic to look at gene order in blocks between different species. And flies are actually an excellent resource for this because we now have the complete genome sequence for many different species of fruit flies. So between closely related species, we can begin to investigate these issues as well. Here are just two references that I'm going to draw my next few figures from discussing this type of thing. So what you see on the right is a phylogeny of different Drosophilid species. Here's what their karyotypes look like. So this is a pictorial representation of their chromosome complement. And the color coding is highlighting what are called Müller elements. So this is blocks of DNA that are syntonous with one another. They retain the same information in the same order, generally speaking, but they are found in different chromosomal arrangements in these different species. You can also see that there's evidence for fusion events, for breakage events, for large-scale inversions, and that sort of thing when you look between the different species. Okay. Here's just a graphical representation of this between a number of different species. What you see when a line goes straight across is that you've got the same genes in exactly the same order. These little lines indicate genes, sections of DNA, and where they are where their corresponding location is in different genomes. What you can see, for example, with Drosophila melanogaster at the top and with Drosophila erecta just below is that there is a large amount of conservation of syntony between these different organisms. With a few exceptions, you can see with those sort of constrictions, that's a large-scale inversion where there's something that's just flipped over and now everything's in a different orientation. But for the most part, you can see that there's high correspondence. Large blocks of genes are present in the same spatial orientation. And then the farther down you go, you can see it becomes more different because we're presumably talking about more distant speciation events. So what you can do with this type of analysis is you can actually count how many genes come in a block. How many genes are there in a block of syntony that you can compare between these two different organisms? And what you do, or what can be done, is you can plot the number of blocks of different sizes as a function of presumed time since divergence. So what we see here is for these species, this is comparing it to Drosophila melanogaster, these two other species presumed to be quite close relatives of Drosophila melanogaster. And what you can see is there's still very large blocks of syntony up to the order of, say, 1,500 genes. There's a number there, and then down to blocks that only conserve, say, two genes together. And what we see is when we look at other species presumed to have been more distantly related, speciated at an earlier time, based on other criteria, molecular clocks and such, what you can see is that the farther away you get from Drosophila melanogaster, presumably in time, these blocks of syntony on average become smaller, presumably reflecting recombination, breakage and rejoining, and reshuffling of these large blocks into smaller blocks over time. Now again, This is a prediction that's made on molecular clocks of individual genes that does not presume this particular phylogeny based on this data. So this is a prediction that is supported. Okay. People don't really care about fruit fly evolution. The individuals at your church do not lie awake at night contemplating if Drosophila pseudoobscura is related to Drosophila melanogaster. That's just not an issue. As a geneticist, I feel that perhaps it should be an issue, but but where the rubber meets the road, as you well know, is this issue of human common ancestry with other forms of life, specifically other great apes. So the question then becomes, okay, now that you've learned a little bit about what syntony is, and you have an appreciation for the homology argument in terms of the identity over vast swaths of the genome, the question then becomes, well, do we have the same genes in the same order? How do we look in terms of a syntony arrangement between humans and other forms of life, say gorillas or chimpanzees? So this is a comparison between human chromosomes and chimpanzee chromosomes. You have the human chromosome on the left. You have the chimpanzee equivalent on the right. And this is just based on a low-level DNA stain, just to give a graphic representation of what these chromosomes look like. This was done back in the 80s, and you can see that there's quite a striking correspondence between the two sets. The most notable difference, as you're probably aware, is the human chromosome 2 issue, which you can see there over on the left, where what we see as one chromosome in humans is present as syntonous groups of those genes on those two chromosome arms in humans are present on two separate chromosomes in chimps and also in gorillas. So the question then becomes, in that specific instance, okay, most of the rest, this is just a subset, but most of the rest of the genome is aligned quite closely. What we're looking at here is something that's more similar to closely related Drosophila species as opposed to rapidly or widely divergent Drosophila species. Okay, let's have a little bit of a look at this chromosome 2 issue because it's something that I think you can't really have a talk about this without touching on that one, right? So here's a closer look at the syntony argument for this region. We're looking at human chromosome 2, and we've got comparisons between a couple of chromosomes in chimpanzee on the next one over and gorilla as well. And what you can't quite see from the distance is there's all these lines indicating where the relative genes are between these two organisms. And what you see, of course, is that they're in the same relative locations with a few exceptions that can be explained in terms of inversions or, in this one case, this fusion, this telomeric end-to-end fusion of chromosomes, presumably. If we have a closer look at this little area right here, just so you can see it, what we see, and this points to the next portion of the talk, talking about pseudogenes, you can consider those sequences such as the centromere. This is the portion of the chromosome where the cell microtubules attach to move chromosomes around. That's a specific sequence. Human chromosome 2 as a fusion has a functional centromere, as you would expect, but it also has a centromere-like sequence that's been inactivated due to mutation in the exact syntonous area that you would predict it to be so based on comparison with chimpanzee and gorilla chromosomes. Okay. Now, perhaps one might want to make the argument, this is sort of my anti-evolution interlocutor speaking throughout the different talk, and we'll speak to this in a bit. Perhaps this isn't common descent that we're looking at, perhaps there's some deeper underlying function that's being driven by this order of genes. I'll leave that as an open question. I don't believe there's good support for that, but it's certainly a question worth raising because it's likely the answer that's going to come back as you discuss these things. Okay, moving on to pseudogeny or pseudogenes. We've already seen sort of an example of this with that inactivated centromere that we see on chromosome 2, as well as the telomere, the tip sequences are also present at the presumed fusion point as well. Okay, so what is exactly a pseudogene? These are sometimes referred to simply as junk DNA. We've had a little bit of that from Bruce Gordon's talk. But what I'm specifically going to be focusing on, there's sometimes a confusion between something so-called junk DNA versus non-coding DNA. Well, non-coding DNA, of course, has tons of functions. Nobody's arguing against that, and that's been known for a long, long time. What we're speaking of when we're speaking of pseudogenes is sequences that have clear signs of once having been a functional gene, but also now have clear signs of being inactivated or no longer performing their original function. And the analogy here with this image of if you were walking across a field and came across this entity, you would have no hesitation in ascribing that it once had a certain function that you can recognize. And you would also notice quite readily, because of the absence of the roof, et cetera, that it's no longer performing that original function. Now, there may well be important functions that this entity is performing in terms of environmental or ecological habitat for given organisms, et cetera. But that understanding does not invalidate the argument that this entity is no longer performing its original function. Those things are separable. All right, so what does this look like at the genetic level? There are many, many examples of this type of thing, and I'm going to focus only on one. There are things such as endogenous retroviruses, repeat DNA, lines and signs, and things like that. Many, many, many different examples. I'm going to focus on the one example that the anti-evolution or anti-common descent movement has the most trouble explaining, and that is this notion of what are called unitary pseudogenes. So these are sequences that are coding sequences, presumably once coding sequences. They've been inactivated due to mutation, and they're not present anywhere else in the genome. They're not a copy. Sometimes we hear about pseudogenes that are the result of transcription and reinsertion of the transcript and that sort of thing, process pseudogenes and whatnot. Here we're simply looking at what appear to be functional, once functional DNA sequences that provided a protein that has been inactivated due to mutation and is no longer present in the genome. What's interesting is now that we've been doing comparative genomics and looking at this between different organisms, based on syntony, we now know where to go looking in other organisms, perhaps for the functional version of that gene, if that makes sense. Okay, so some examples. Here's a paper discussing protein receptors that are important in our olfactory sense. So these are the protein receptors that bind to chemicals that we breathe in that transduce those signals to our nervous system. Approximately 60% of our complement of these types of receptors have been pseudogenized. We contain only a very small fraction relative to other mammals in terms of functional versions of these genes. And we can look at these genes in other mammals, and they're in the same relative spatial orientation. So the syntony argument checks out. The homology argument checks out. And even the redundancy argument checks out, in that they're precisely what we would predict them to be in terms of where they are and the sequence that they have, yet they've been inactivated due to mutation. So just some examples. You won't be able to see this from here, but if you're interested, the paper, I think this one's freely accessible. What is even more striking is that we see a pattern where, in some cases, these pseudogenes have identical inactivating mutations in various organisms. So, for example, here, if you look at one with the 302 deletion up near the top, that's shared between humans, chimps, and gorillas. Same relative location, same sequence, homologous sequence, same codon usage, same inactivating mutation in these three different organisms. That becomes a bit challenging from an anti-descent viewpoint to envision how this pattern could possibly be in that sense. We also see some cases where deletion or inactivations are human-specific, and we see some cases where it's just shared, say, between humans and chimps, but not gorillas and things like that. So there's a variety of patterns that are available. Okay, here's just another example. This is a nuclear receptor. So this is a gene that's it's expressed on the nuclear envelope, and it's involved in sensing a certain hormone, steroid hormone. And here we have it in humans. So its chromosomal location, you can't see the fine lines that indicate where it is on the chromosome. The next bar down shows its relative genotypic context, the nearby genes in this little region. And then down below, you can't quite see it, but the points, the little asterisks, indicate where different inactivating mutations are present in this sequence. Now, what's interesting is if you look in mice, that we see this gene is in the same genomic context in mice as it is in humans. It's in the same block of syntony. It has the same spatial orientation to the same homologous genes around it. In the case of mice, it's a functional receptor. It has a phenotype when you knock it out, etc. So why is it that humans have this sequence in the exact same genomic location relative to mice, and yet we see it inactivated through mutation? That becomes a bit challenging from a non-common descent design view. Here's just making the point a little bit more thoroughly in terms of the identity and homology of what's going on. This is the top sequence is the human sequence of the first little bit of this gene, the ATG on the left-hand side indicating the start codon. And just a comparison with the next one down is with chimps. Chimps have the same sequence in the same location relative to the same genes around it, and they share, and it's in terms of this little segment, it's identical in terms of its sequence, including one inactivating mutation that you can see right here, where there's a deletion that's taken place, causing a frame shift mutation, rendering this gene untranslatable. And yet we see, again, conservation of syntony, homology, redundancy in between these two organisms. And the real kicker is we know what this gene does. We can look at it in mice. We know what its function is. We can look at it in humans. It's certainly not performing that function anymore. It can't because of its deletion or its mutations that it's accumulated. Even if in the future some function is found for this particular pseudogene or any pseudogene in this category, it still does not remove the force of those arguments from an evolutionary common descent point of view. Here's one that I like to use as an example because it's an issue that speaks to our evolutionary history, and it's an issue that combines the force of the arguments that we've seen with previous pseudogenes and adds a component of knowledge of in terms of what this gene does in that it's adapted to a former way of life that we no longer use. So this is a gene called vitelogenin that we're talking about. And again, this article is freely available online that you can look at. It's a question of, okay, mammals are presumably descended from egg-laying ancestors. Egg-laying ancestor or egg-laying organisms use specific genes to load up yolk content for nutrition for their young. That provides the hypothesis that these genes which do this function, we may be able to find the remnants of those genes in our own genome. And based on syntony, we now know where to go digging. We can look where these functional versions of these genes remain in egg-laying animals, such as chickens, for example. We can use that as a predictive. We know the spatial orientation of what genes are next to it. We can look in the genomic sequences that we now have, and we can sort of do genetic archaeology. We can go digging in that sequence and say, are the remnants of this sequence present? And obviously, I wouldn't be showing you the slide if it didn't pan out. So here's just a phylogeny of mammals. We are what are called eutherians, so we're placental mammals. We use a placenta for nutrition during embryonic development. There are still a few versions of egg-laying mammals that are present. You're probably familiar with the platypus as one example of a monotreme, so an egg-laying mammal. And then there are metatherians as well, so the different marsupials. And what you find if you go digging genomically, so here now is a scatter plot that looks at the sequence in the region of syntony where this entity is predicted to be. If we're going to find a defunct vitelogenin locus or sequence, we're going to find it in this specific block of syntony. And it's difficult to see, but basically what you've got on the one side, on the one axis is the human sequence, and on the top axis you've got chicken, which has functional versions. There are three copies, actually, of this particular protein, three copies of this locus, this protein. And what you can see quite convincingly, although perhaps you can't see it, you can read the paper, is that the remnant sequences of this gene are present in exactly the position that you would predict them to be based on syntony and common descent. And yet they are hugely inactivated. if we're talking genetic archaeology here, I showed the picture of that sort of defunct stone building with missing the roof. Here we're basically peeling back the grass, and we can find the foundation outline after, and that's sort of the equivalent of what we're seeing here. But it's in the right place, and it's in the right place, and it has the remnants of the right sequence. Again, very challenging from a non-evolutionary design point of view. So the fallback position, of course, is that it will have a function. This entity cannot be there without having some sort of function. And I haven't made the point, but if you look at chimpanzees, it's the same sequence in the same spot. Right? I'm just looking at the comparison was with something that has a functional version of that gene. The fact that we see identical inactivation mutations between different species is also a challenge. You end up perhaps having to propose, well, there's some underlying function or non-randomness of these inactivating mutations that's producing this pattern. And as you can see, the reasoning becomes, I believe, more and more strained. Okay, so just to briefly run through this from the point of what I believe the most parsimonious explanation for this data is before we move on to population genetics is pretty simple. We have two competing hypotheses. We have common descent, and we have some sort of non-common descent designer. And again, I'm restricting the discussion to those two categories. I'm aware that there are other categories available, but these suit our purposes. In terms of homology, redundancy, syntony, and pseudogeny, what we see is what we predict based on common descent. And moreover, the syntony that we observe is consistent with a recent divergence. How does this work from a non-evolutionary, non-common descent point of view? Well, you have to make an argument repeatedly that the designer somehow chose or was constrained to an appearance of these things. So an appearance of common descent as a constraint of perhaps some unknown, as of yet unknown, function. And I think you'll agree with me, at least in the face of the evidence, that that is a less likely explanation in terms of compared to common descent. Okay. So that's the first half of the talk, or the first portion of the talk. Now we're going to move into some discussions that are a little more esoteric and not quite as qualitative, so it's a little bit difficult to appreciate the data, but we'll do our best. This is also a little bit outside my field, so this is going to be sort of All right, well, it'll be fast then. My apologies. All right, okay. So there's different ways of using genomics data to infer ancestral population sizes. I'm going to speak to two different versions, and the first I'll speak to more thoroughly, and then the last I'll just gloss over because of time. The issue is, now that we can recognize the different amounts of genetic heterogeneity in human populations, this provides us with a mechanism for estimating population sizes, in a nutshell. What I think perhaps the most compelling way to do this has been now with the advent of complete genomic sequences, is to look at sequences compared between different organisms, humans, chimps, gorillas, orangutans in this particular example, and begin to ask the question of, we see sequences that are, for the most part, conform to this pattern here. This pattern here is the prediction that any given sequence between humans and chimps would converge or coalesce between these two species before that sequence coalesces with chimpanzees and gorillas, with gorillas farther up. What is striking is that there is a small but significant fraction of our genome that does not conform to that pattern. There are certain portions of our genome that are more closely related at face value to gorillas. Here's just a schematic example or a data set from this paper that you can look at. It's open access, that assesses the probability of different related states across the genome. What we see for the most part across the genome is that issue of we converge or coalesce most quickly with the chimpanzee sequence. But there's a certain and significant fraction that doesn't. And you can see, like wherever it's a red bar, that's where we're coalescing with chimpanzee. But then the blue or the green, is where we're coalescing more rapidly with other great apes. The take-home message, and it's difficult to explain briefly and succinctly, but that type of pattern is not consistent with a bottleneck that passes through only two individuals. You cannot maintain that amount of genetic diversity from those distinct species through a bottleneck event of only two individuals. The estimates for population size based on this data will range only as low, even in extreme cases, to about 1,000 individuals. The only way to get around that data is to say, okay, you can have a smaller population size, but then the speciation time is longer and more complex, and there's more gene flow between the two populations during the speciation event. Neither of those options is theologically palatable. So if you want a fast speciation through two ancestors, the data is just not going there. There you go. That's the short version. Okay. We'll skip the linkage disequilibrium studies. So what do we see in terms of population genetics? We see a complex speciation through a large ancestral population, and again, same argument from the non-evolutionary design point of view. Okay. Some very brief thoughts on scientific concordism, and I feel free not to speak too long to this because of the theologians following. In essence, it's not a good idea in my mind. This is what I view as what I call ratcheting concordism versus the actual ancient Near Eastern phenomenological perspective that we'll hear spoken to shortly. What I mean by ratcheting concordism is this notion of, in the face of overwhelming evidence, you take your position and go, I really don't like that. You ratchet over one position and there you lock in until another point of evidence moves you further and further. And I would counter that that's perhaps not a higher view of Scripture and leave it there. My apologies for going over. The question is the homology figure between humans and chimps. It depends on what you're measuring. If you include insertion and deletion mutations, the estimates appear to be about the 95% mark.
So you would say that's close?
Yes.
Then what makes the difference between a chimp and a human?
The question is, well then, in the face of this overwhelming correspondence, what makes us different? And the response there is it seems that gene regulation, small changes in gene regulation, can accomplish quite a bit. There's an ongoing discussion right now as in terms of the relative contribution of protein structural changes versus the regulatory changes that control those sequences. At this point, it looks like the evidence is leaning towards more changes in regulatory sequences over opposed to structural changes, but there are some structural changes too, so it's going to be a bit of both. Yes. Sure. So the question is just a request for a comment between this new line of data, which has mostly come out sort of since 2005 when the chimpanzee genome became available, and how it lines up with other lines of evidence. And, the answer there is that this is an independent set of data that speaks to the same conclusion. So what we see here is a convergence of independent lines of inquiry that arrive at the same conclusion, which is what you look for in science in terms of support for a theoretical framework. Yeah, thank you. Indeed. That particular paper discusses population, ancestral population size for the human, chimp, gorilla common ancestor, as well as the human chimp common ancestor. The bottom line, well, it depends where where one wishes to place, if one is so inclined to try to map Adam and Eve onto this map. Probably most individuals would try to put that at the human-chimp divergence point. And the population size, at a minimum, is not less than 1,000 by the evidence that we have now. Randy. Sure. The question is to comment on the on mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosome Adam. I specifically avoided that for this particular talk, because that only shows us the coalescence or common ancestry of a very small part of our genome. And the Y chromosome in terms of males and the extra nuclear mitochondrial genome for us, for males and females. That only tells us in terms of population size post-speciation. The issue here, and the evidence there is that there have been various bottlenecks of population size during human population sort of expansion and migration. But that just talks about our most recent common ancestor in terms of living humans for very defined portions of our genetic material. Whereas now what we're seeing is an analysis of that type of thing compared to chimpanzees at a genome-wide level. So it speaks to a different time in human evolution. Does that answer your question? So the question is along the lines of how can we compare this type of evidence to what we see in forensics with usage of DNA sequencing in court cases. It is an extrapolation of the same principles. You can do a molecular phylogeny for different human groupings and look at DNA variation within modern-day humans, and what you see is clustering of sequence similarity, clustering based on sequence similarity clusters individuals into different geographic and ethnic groups. That's what you see. It's at a very, very fine level. There are very, very few differences, but it's the same principle. So, yes, this is an extrapolation based on those same principles. Thank you very much.